Welcome to the 71st episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
Welcome to the podcast with all the style of a Mitchell Johnson moustache.
And I'll let that opening line pass without comment because we've got some far better things coming up in this podcast than that. We are going to be talking about our highlights and lowlights from the last few weeks, including some T20 internationals and some happenings in a small sports bar in North London. I'm going to be looking over the history of Australia's indigenous cricketers. We're going to be reviewing BBC Five Live sports special, The Art of Captaincy, with Michael Vaughan and Mike Brearley. And, of course, we're going to be looking forward to Edgbaston and the third Ashes test. But going back to the last couple of weeks, what has been pleasing you in the world of cricket, Andy?
Well, India surprised a lot of people by actually agreeing to go on an admittedly fairly brief tour of Zimbabwe. And in the midst of all the ongoing instability in Zimbabwe, the rank incompetence on the part of their board, and the steady exodus to England and county cricket of a lot of their best players, I find it astonishing that Zimbabwe continue to get an actually competitive team out on the field. They were never humiliated during this tour, sort of competitive throughout. But what was really pleasing is they actually won the final game, their first ever victory over India in a 2020. You can't go around proclaiming this as a sort of great turning point for Zimbabwe cricket. There's far too many problems for that. But I think it's just a pleasure to see that their determined, long-suffering players occasionally are having moments of success. And you think, actually, these moments of success are going to be crucial for keeping the game alive there.
Well, absolutely. And in terms of the kind of international scene as well, it does vindicate the ability of Zimbabwe, the kind of continuing ability of Zimbabwe to be playing international cricket. Because when, you know, you have teams that just turn into the sort of whipping boys of the international scene, then there's actually no reason. It's very difficult to justify why you carry on putting them out for tours where they get smashed time and time again. So actually what's important as well as the victory is the fact that they actually never really got, you know, they didn't get hammered throughout the entire series. That's in a sense part of the joy of the series.
I agree with that, because I think you would look at it from India's perspective and see they actually got something out of that tour. And admittedly, they took a slightly weakened side, not a ridiculously weakened side, but definitely more of a second string. But they would look at that and say, you know, that wasn't a waste of time. So hopefully more teams will follow suit. So far from Harare, let's go back to this mysterious sports bar in North London.
Yeah, absolutely. So a few weeks ago, I came back to the... Obviously, I'm based in Sydney at the moment, and I came back to the UK for a few weeks, mostly to see my sister get very, very happily married. But also, it was exactly that. You've kind of put me off my stride now. And also to do, you know, see various friends, etc., etc. And one of the highlights of the trip, actually, was when I saw you, Andy. But actually, it wasn't because I was seeing you at all. That wasn't why it was a highlight. It was a highlight because actually we ended up meeting in a sports bar in North London, I believe, called the Jet Lag Sports Bar, which is very appropriate for me, having just got off a flight from Sydney, where you were engaged in some commentary with Gorilla Cricket. And I'd sort of come across Gorilla Cricket a little bit in the past, as much as anything, because you've done some work with them, and we've interviewed one of their number on the podcast before. But it really struck me. So we were sitting in this sports bar, and basically the way it works is there's a team of commentators, and they commentate over the kind of PA system in the sports bar to the cricket that's happening on screens around us. And it just struck me what a kind of wonderful kind of community they were building there, kind of live in person. The fact that, you know, you have people sitting around with beers listening to the commentary that was happening live and watching the cricket, but also just, you know, that sense of sort of a group of friends really commentating on the cricket. And actually saying group of friends is to underestimate it a bit, because the quality of the commentary is absolutely astounding. But it was actually a really, really sort of impressive and heartening thing to see, I think.
Well, I think you talked about community, and I think that's what I've found very enjoyable about getting involved within Gorilla Cricket, in that it's really quite a wonderful community of very different people, all sorts of walks of life, different sort of ages, stages and whatever. And what is produced in terms of commentary is that it reflects that. It really is quite different. You know, if you start with a lot of people who are really united only by their love of cricket, I think you end up with quite an interesting product. And I agree that there is a lot of fun in this new Gorilla Cricket setup in the Jet Lag, this sort of live audience and all this. Long may it continue.
So this is a bar near, where is it near? Near
Near
sort of
Warren
Holborn?
Street? Yeah, Holborn Warren
Warren
Street one,
Street.
yeah.
So if you can get there, are there broadcasting from there during the second test, is
I
that
know,
right?
the guerrilla cricket never stops. It keeps going.
There we
Third
go.
test, fourth
Guerrilla
test.
cricket, the guerrilla war never stops. So if you can get there, we would heartily recommend you do. They have pretty good beer on tap as well. Now, of course, when we were there, we were talking about the, well, it was during the second Ashes test, and you know, as England fans, that's something that we don't want to reflect on too much. But quite a lot of the mainstream media reflected on it quite viciously, didn't they?
Well, I mean, I think it's hardly a newsflash to say that the British press lacks a sense of perspective, but I got particularly frustrated reading the match reports of the second test. You know, the word that particularly struck me, several papers described the defeat as shameful. And I thought, well, you're describing not playing well as somehow an immoral act. And I think, you know, which is clearly shows a total lack of perspective. But also on top of that, there are a lot of reflections on, oh God, you know, the supporters have paid £90 a day to be here and they bat like that. And I thought, no, that's not how watching cricket works. You don't pay to watch England win. You pay to spectate a match, a contest, to be part of that narrative. And actually, if you're an England supporter, to put up with, you know, the highs and the lows. And I thought there was a sort of quite bitter sense of entitlement about a lot of the coverage. And you think a lot of these journalists presumably got into covering cricket because they loved the game. And you read some of this and you thought there didn't seem to be any of that spirit of fun that got them into the game in the first place.
I know that there is, you know, some for me, some of the best cricket writers and commentators are the ones who, you know, in the words of the Rudyard Kipling poem, can take victory and defeat and, you know, however it goes after that. But you know, with a
Treat
kind of
those two
with an
imposters just the same.
there we go, poetry on demand. What more can you want from a Westwood Radio? But actually, that's, you know, someone like Vic Marks after this test. Absolutely, the words kind of shameful weren't used. Yes, he was very damning, but there's a kind of humour that comes along with it as well. The other thing I find sometimes quite sort of amusing is the way that, you know, after the first test, the entire press were saying, you know, oh, dad, you know, Australia's dad's army, are they going to be able to cope? They're going to have to think about wholesale changes. England, aren't they the greatest team that ever existed? And then after the second test, oh my God, aren't England the worst team that ever existed? Aren't Australia the best team that ever existed? And actually, any kind of, well, perspective, but in a different sense from what you were talking about, does seem to be really lacking in that sense as
I
well.
thought it was very interesting. Some of the players I play cricket with, their response almost universally when we were watching some of it was, what, did anyone expect Australia not to win a test match in this series? You know, and that's actually the kind of perspective that obviously a lot of supporters probably do have, and the media is sometimes lacking in.
Yeah, but having said all of that, England were pretty rubbish.
Well, they were rubbish, but were they shameful?
Question for another time.
On the subject of shameful, let's go to the
Yes.
IPL.
Yeah, let's go to the IPL. Now, anyone who listens to this podcast regularly will know that we don't have much time for the IPL at Reverse Rep Radio. We tend really not to watch it and just generally to pretend that it doesn't really happen. But sometimes, kind of as people who try to engage with the game of cricket, we sort of have to acknowledge sometimes that it does happen. And actually, I've been quite interested recently by all the goings on, all the legal goings on with the match fixing cases that have been brought against the three Rajasthan Royals India players. I mean, with Srisanth being the most famous of all of them. Now, it's always struck me with, you know, cricket just has this really bizarre thing that we know that match fixing is a thing, all the way from Hansi Kronia through to the Pakistani spot fixing in England, through to all of the other things that's happening. We know that match fixing is an ish big issue for cricket at the moment. We also know that the IPL is basically run by money. We therefore know that match fixing plus IPL equals big needs to be managed in some way. And one of the kind of shameful, as you say, things about the situation is just quite how inept the BCCI have been at actually managing to handle it. And actually, this particular case goes back to 2013, some allegations from 2013 against these players. And essentially, the BCCI, the Board of Cricket Control in India, banned, placed life bans on all three players. And then they referred them, probably quite rightly, to a civil court in India and said, we need to actually you know, try them for fraud and all of these other things that they've been doing, which I think is probably a good idea. The issue was that they didn't really think it through, and then the courts have just come back. They came back yesterday or the day before yesterday and basically said there's just insufficient evidence to ever convict them, so we're just going to have to throw the case out, which just leaves the whole thing in just such a mess for a few reasons. Firstly, and most significantly, because you wonder how the BCCI could actually have, you know, convicted the players themselves and given them life bans if there isn't sufficient evidence. So it's quite damning on the BCCI's methods of reaching a verdict. And it also just brings into question the ability of the BCCI to actually run its own affairs if it's actually not able to bring kind of civil convictions for its own rules that it's laying down.
I guess what I'm curious of from a very much an outsider's perspective on this is, will all of this, because there's this separate scandal going on, which I admit I've totally failed to follow, with a couple of the team owners there potentially being banned, will all this impact on the IPL's popularity long term, or is it actually such a machine now with such a big following within the country that actually it's capable of just kind of bulldozing its way through this sort of controversy, and actually we'll get to the next season, the grounds will still be full, you know, the TV money will still be coming in, or will this, it'd be interesting, will this start to have an effect?
I'm just not sure anyone really cares, to be honest. You know, in the same way that people buy from Amazon even though they don't pay any taxes.
Yeah.
You know, we all think they're immoral, but everyone still uses them. And, you know, one of the great successes of the IPL has been kind of audience building. And all of these new audiences, they're not the kind of people who have grown up on Test cricket thinking about the integrity of the game, whatever. They just like watching whoever it is slamming sixes for, you know, for an evening. So I'm just not convinced, unfortunately, that it is going to have any bearing. But only time will tell.
From the archives, and in this episode and the next episode, Toby is going to be giving us a history of Australia's indigenous cricketers. In part one today, he is going to start with the infamous 1868 Aboriginal Tour of England.
It seems odd to say that we're going to do a two-part series on Australia's indigenous cricketers, and the first part only takes us up to 1868. But when I tell you that in this first part we'll cover the beginnings of the Boxing Day test match tradition, and also the first ever Australian tour onto English soil. The roots of cricket within the Australian indigenous population go back to the 19th century, and as so often with cricket around the world, it came as part of, well, British colonisation, essentially. And actually, it came as part of the unfortunate phrase of civilising the indigenous population, which is what particularly the church was doing throughout Australia in the 19th century. Bishop Salvado was the man who took it to Western Australia, for instance, and Western Australia, which then really was the back of beyond. Actually, you know, the indigenous team there became one of the best in all of Australia. Initially, the idea of taking indigenous cricket teams and teams made up of colonial settlers and playing them against one another was seen as a good thing, at least in business terms. There was a guy called William Hayman who set up a game in 1866 between the Melbourne Cricket Club 11, an Aboriginal cricket team, and about 10,000 spectators turned out for this. And obviously at the time, when the British colony wasn't all that big, that was a significant number of people.
Is it quite surprising that there wasn't more, frankly, racism that would have prevented something like this? Because actually it feels quite forward thinking. I mean, you know, you look to the, you know, well into the 20th century, and there were problems with black sportsmen being allowed to compete against white sportsmen. Anything, actually, the fact that in 1866 you're able to get 10,000 people to watch a settlers team play, in an odd way, is that a quite a sign of tolerance, or is that reading too much into it?
Well, no, I think there are a couple of things, one of which is the kind of curiosity element that a lot of people would have felt about the idea of indigenous people playing a game that was very much an English game. You know, how is this going to work out? You know, us pitting our best against the best of the indigenous cricketers, just a kind of curiosity thing. But certainly, you know, one of the big challenges that was faced in the early years of the British settlement of Australia was simply this fact that there was a large indigenous population who was there. Initially, the basically the idea was just to wipe them out. Mm-hmm. And so after, you know, after 1788, when Australia was settled, in inverted commas, you kind of have to put everything when you talk about Australia's colonial history into inverted commas, was settled, the idea was just to wipe the indigenous population out. But then actually after a while, they sort of realized, as much as anything, because that was both logistically difficult and obviously highly immoral, they realized that actually trying to maintain a degree of kind of cohesion between the indigenous and the settling populations was an important thing. And actually this game that happened in 1866 was the first ever Boxing Day test. It happened in Melbourne, where all of the boxing, sorry, it wasn't obviously the first Boxing Day test, it was the first Boxing Day match, and it started that tradition. It happened in Melbourne. To this day, we have games in Melbourne every Boxing Day, which is, you know, an interesting fact that that thing that we think of as a staple of international cricket was actually something that was started with an indigenous team. And actually, the idea was that this would be the start of a tour for this indigenous team that would go around Australia and then would go to England. However, and I made the reference earlier to the fact that, you know, there were real commercial interests in this whole setup. Unfortunately, the way that it worked out was that the indigenous cricketers were just never paid for what they were doing. They were kind of toured around the country, and then they were just abandoned without any pay in Sydney, without any money at all.
What's extraordinary about this is we've done a lot of stuff on the origins of English cricket and how it actually all starts with dodgy businessmen, doesn't it? And it's funny, when we go to the IPL and we bemoan, you know, the influence of money on the game, we sometimes forget that this is just, you know, this is just another example about how cricket in its early stages of development, it was driven by these wheeler dealers, wasn't it? You know, these first games were, you know, could they get a crowd in, you know, could they sell some beer on top of the game, all this sort of stuff, bit of gambling.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, all of this stuff is, you know, highly reminiscent of, I mean, Mike Marcusay could really get his teeth into this topic. So the result actually was that this team that had played the first Boxing Day match in Melbourne ended up getting stranded in Sydney, and this was actually quite a serious thing, because for a lot of these indigenous people, actually they basically couldn't put up with the weather that was basically cold and damp in the winter that they had to spend in Sydney, and a lot of them died from pneumonia and other diseases because they didn't have any money to get out of Sydney, and stuck in Sydney they were just, you know, just out of their element in the most literal sense. In terms of indigenous cricket at large, all was not lost, and enter Charles Lawrence, good old English name for an Englishman indeed, who had toured Australia as part of the first ever visit of an English team to the country, which happened in 1861 and had then stayed on. Now, again, there's this question as to whether he was motivated by financial interest or a genuine sort of cricketing and philanthropic desire. But he stepped in, he organised a series of benefit matches, raised the necessary funds, and then set up a tour to England for this indigenous team. And the boat carrying them finally arrived in the UK on the 13th of May, 1860, after a three-month voyage. And this was the first time that an Australian team had ever set foot on English soil to play cricket. And it was made up entirely of Aboriginals.
This must have been an absolutely, for them, this must have been both an extraordinarily exciting, but also probably quite a terrifying, in terms of being out of your comfort zone. And I think what I get the sense from sort of your story, that actually they probably had relatively little choice in this. They were, you know, you get the sense that they were almost just a small part of this kind of almost business proposition.
I think that's very true, and a lot of the accounts, both from the time and in terms of the accounts that you read now, don't actually say much about that. But there are these figures like Charles Lawrence who you think probably stood quite a lot to gain by actually putting these tours together. So, you know, it is, and there are very few accounts actually from the Aboriginals themselves. One thing that actually strikes me thinking about it is that when we were reading, it was Gary Saber's book, wasn't it, King Cricket, about when that appalling book he wrote about kind of touring England and various other things. And one of the things he talks about is when you come from the West Indies and it's just really, really cold in England, and people just, you know, they get ill, etc., etc. And actually, in terms of for these Aboriginal cricketers, it was a massive issue, and actually one of their number ended up dying from a combination of pneumonia and tuberculosis when they're in the UK, simply from the cold weather of an English summer, which is just something that they were just not used to in any way whatsoever. So whether they did it willingly or out of coercion, really, is an interesting question. What's certainly true is that once they were in the UK, they played an awful lot of cricket. They got their journey's worth, their 6 month on a boat's worth of cricket. They played 47 matches, which in really kind of raises the question of when we talk about burnout in terms of professional players nowadays, playing 47 matches in something like 2 months, I think it was, really, is a bit of a statement. The Sporting Life magazine, as it then was in the UK, said this, and I quote, "No 11 has ever in one season played so many matches so successfully, never playing fewer than two matches in each week and frequently three, bearing an amount of fatigue that now seems incredible." And in fact, the squad was just made up of 13 players, so it wasn't as if they were swapping players in and out
This
all the
does
time.
suggest to play that many games. There was obviously a huge demand. People wanted to see it. People wanted to play them. This obviously had. You could see that if it was seen as a novelty, really, you could see maybe a couple of games. But to play 47 games, people obviously took the thing actually very, very seriously. But you said that
Absolutely,
there
and
was
I.
actually maybe more to it than just the cricket.
Well, there was, and I think there were two things that made it so appealing. One of which is that the fact that the team was quite good. So they played 47 matches, 19 ended in draws, and then their win-loss ratio, which probably wasn't a phrase that was ever used at the time, was completely balanced out at 14 matches apiece, and they drew huge crowds all over the country. They only just lost Surrey, and this was a well-established side that they nearly beat. And then a few of the cricketers actually developed a real reputation. So there was a guy called Johnny Muller, who obviously that wasn't his name, but no one could actually pronounce their names, and so they gave them these names. And he was known became known as the Black WG Grace amongst the English press, which is quite an interesting thing. And actually ended up having a monument erected to him in Harrow School, of all things. And then the fast bowler Johnny Cousins as well became pretty well known for his pace and accuracy. But as you say, it wasn't just the cricket that people were turning up for, even though that was high quality. They also arrived to see what was known as sports, which happened on the day after the matches, and it consisted of all kinds of things, including traditional indigenous events such as boomerang throwing. There were also contests in running the 100 yards backwards. I don't think that's necessarily a traditional indigenous thing, but quite fun nevertheless. But actually, more interestingly, sports where there was genuine danger. So there was a cricketer who became known by the name Dicker Dick, and he would do this thing where he would stand with just a parrying shield and a liangle, which is a kind of war club, and people would just be able to throw spears and cricket balls at him from as short a distance as they liked. And throughout the entire tour, he was only hit once. But these, genuine war spears were just being hurled at him from about 5 meters away, and he was sort of, trying to fend them off. Another crowd pleaser was the game at which you collect a few group of your teammates together, make them stand in one place, and then throw spears at them from a distance until they were surrounded by a ring of spears, with the sharp ends of the spears in the ground, which is a one you can just imagine that happening at the county ground in Taunton nowadays, can't you?
Again, it's interesting if you compare this to the present day, and you think actually this idea of making cricket about more than the match. I mean, traditionalists often get very upset when you have things like whether it's cheerleaders or flamethrowers next to it. But you realise that actually cricket crowds have actually this is a great example that actually there's always been that appetite for sort of a cricket match plus the added entertainment. Although
Well,
frankly,
it's
the
interesting.
preponderance of spears here is maybe slightly concerning and something that today's
It's
health and
slightly
safety would
alarming.
have much to say about.
And in fact, in comparison to today, Lords had an M the MCC had a big meeting before the game that the Indigenous team played at Lords, and discussed whether these sports, as they were called, should be able to take place. And they decided that they shouldn't. The match finished early, though, and on the second day they had the afternoon free, and they went out and played these sports, and everyone loved them. And then the MCC turned around and said, "Okay, maybe we should have allowed them after all, seeing as everyone loved them." So some things never change. To the review, and this episode we have been listening to a radio show. We have been listening to the BBC Five Live Sports Special Series, and in particular the episode called The Art of Captaincy. It's available for download from iTunes or indeed from iPlayer for a couple more days, I think. And it consists essentially of an interview between two former England captains, between Michael Vaughan and Mike Brearley, whose book, The Art of Captaincy, marks its 30th anniversary this year. Andy, what caught your ear about this?
It's obviously a wonderful, wonderful idea for a programme to have two great England captains, but great England captains with very different styles having this conversation. So very early on in the interview, Vaughan tries to pin Brearley down on what is captaincy, and Brearley says it is all about being curious about what makes people tick. And I think this is, it really shows Brearley, he is a fan of the man-manager approach rather than the sort of strong leader model. And it did get me thinking, I think it actually... it's probably one way of doing captaincy, but maybe it's not. It's maybe not the only one. And it actually says a lot about Brearley that for him, captaincy was all about that man management. But actually, you think probably there are others who could do it differently.
You do, but I think there are two parts of the kind of the captaincy model that come through here. One of which is that kind of, you know, that sense of leadership, and you know the Henry V speech before the Battle of Agincourt kind of thing, and everything like that. But one of the really interesting things that I found from this podcast was the fact that actually as a captain you have to know your players so well in order to get the best out of them, and that side of captaincy and that side of sort of man management, and it's not about giving speeches, it's about knowing exactly what it is that you need to say to Geoffrey Boycott to get him to bat,
yeah,
you know, to get him to bat better, or to Bob Willis to get him to bowl better.
Well, it was one and of I think the most that, quoted that sense of parts knowing of this programme actually when it came out, and the BBC ran quite a lot with the fact that Brearley had said that Boycott was actually quite sensitive, you know, he needed reassurance, and actually that really got one of the sort of was one of the big headlines of this show. I think you made a good point there where you say it's not about the big speeches, because I think one thing this listening to these two great captains talk, you realise some of the things we assume are a big part of captaincy actually aren't. So Vaughan talks about the fact that big teams bonding speeches were a tiny part of his job. You know, he didn't think they were important. For him, it was all about these one-on-one chats in hotel rooms if necessary. You know, those were the key moments that he thought he did his best work as a captain.
And that actually amusingly, perhaps not amusingly, but slightly tragically, that when there were those moments to get the whole team together before a game and really galvanise them with that speech, that Vaughan never felt he could do it in the dressing room because there were too many support staff around, and that actually the huddle on the pitch, the reason he had the huddle on the pitch, because that was the only place he knew that he could have the, you know, the 11 players who were going to go on the team and have their full attention without anyone else around him.
I thought that was a absolutely fascinating insight, the fact that the dressing room got, and probably says something slightly unfortunate about where England and maybe other international teams have ended up. Now, Brearley talked about a very ambitious and possibly unrealistic aim where he said he wanted all of his 11 thinking as captains. And you think, actually, it is quite an interesting model to aim towards, because what you're actually saying is, when things go wrong, don't look across to me as the captain and say, "Skipper, help." Say, what do I think? What can I solve? And you think, okay, realistically, it doesn't suit every player to be that cerebral. But you think, actually, it is quite a brave way of thinking. And you look at a lot of international teams, and actually, they're nowhere near that. You know, that a lot of international teams are still very dependent on that one guy.
Yep. And when Vaughan's talking about it, he talks a lot about a sense of ownership and you know, having ownership over the way that the game's going. And he talks about the fact that when he played in the Ashes in 2001, he looked at the Australia team and he thought every single person on that pitch, yeah, obviously they want to win, but they also kind of know where the game's going and have a real sense of vision towards what they're doing. Whereas with the England team, it was only ever two or three people, and he had what I thought was an potentially disastrous tactic. Which was, he would say, in order to kind of get people thinking like that, he would just go out to a player and say, right, next over, you are captain. You will tell me who's going to bowl. You're going to tell me what the field is that's going to be set. And exactly towards the end of getting everyone sort of thinking like captain. And you really do get the sense with both of them that actually they didn't really... You know, there are some people who... And Graham Smith is an example who I'm sure you kind of know very much that he is the captain. He is one that everyone listens to. He is, you know, the field marshal. But you get the sense with these two that actually, if he walks into the sort of the dynamic of the dressing room, that actually you wouldn't be immediately aware they were the captain. That wasn't sort of the way it works.
No, and they weren't bothered about that. They weren't, and neither of them seemed to have that sort of ego. I think what I enjoyed as well was hearing a bit about the imaginative side of captaincy. So Brearley talked about the way he would always be sitting there thinking, how is this batsman going to get out? He was trying to imagine the dismissal. And you think, actually, that sometimes, and I you know, Alistair Cook gets a bit of flack in this podcast, actually, and you think maybe that's one of the points that people make when they have a go at Cook for the lack of flair. It's maybe sometimes that imagination to actually think about, okay, with this bowler, with this situation, with this pitch, how what bad shot is this batsman going to play?
I was really interested by when Brearley was talking about tactics and was talking about those, you know, those moments of searing inspiration that captains have when, you know, they take a wicket with a crazy field placement or something. He never actually says that the way that that works is you think, oh, they're going to get out by doing whatever, let's do it. He describes it as a fluke that had some thought behind it. And that, you know, he's talking about the fact that you have to get into the mindset of the batsman and kinds of things that they might do. And it's only by doing that and thinking about the kinds of things that they might do and then acting on something very specific with that might never work, that's actually how those kind of moments of supposed brilliance come across. The other thing is that actually they sort of both come clean, and it is in some ways a very candid discussion between the two of them when they're talking about, you know, past matches and past players who they've worked with. You've talked about boycotts. Vaughan's very honest when it comes to the dismissal of Matthew Hayden at Edgbaston in 2005, when Hayden goes for a duck. In fact, I think it's a golden duck, very first ball. That placement of the short mid-off was not actually a moment of brilliance that he had had. It was simply because Andrew Strauss had been in the loo in the dressing room and was late out onto the field. And so rather than sending him all the way to the slip, he said, oh, why don't you just stay for the first over? Let's just see what happens. We kind of know that Matthew Hayden likes to play in that, you know, direction down the ground early. Let's just stick you in at mid-off and just see what happens. First ball goes straight to mid-off. You know, Vaughan hailed as an absolute captaincy genius, but it was more sort of a hunch that coincided with, you know, with a momentary happening, and it turns into these, you know, what seems to be a moment of genius.
I guess what's really good about that honesty is it means that at the same time you don't take full credit when things go right. It also means presumably you don't beat yourself up quite as much when things go wrong. I thought that there was also an interesting moment of, well, slight humour and also interesting honesty from Vaughan, where he talked about his need to have physically different caps for captaincy and batting. So he would be out in the field in one cap and he would come into the change room, take it off and put on his batting cap. And he said it honestly needed to help. He needed it to help him get into a different mindset. And finally, to the last word, and inevitably there's only one place we can look, and that is to Edgbaston and the third test. And we are asking, 10 years on from the classic that was 2005, are we in for another great game at Edgbaston?
Well, I hope so, is my answer, in short. 2005 Edgbaston was a, you know, it was a brilliant test that will go down long in our memories, as much as anything, because it was the first moment when we all thought, actually, hang on, we can win this. Now, that moment has kind of passed in this series. We had it in the first test in Cardiff. That was the moment where we suddenly all sat up and thought, hang on, can we actually win the series? And the kind of the plot has thickened more significantly since then than it had by the time we got to Edgbaston in 2005, when we just all thought, oh, same old Australia, just going to win the series. Having said that, in this series, the Edgbaston test takes such a pivotal moment. England won the first test, you know, reasonably comfortably, thrashed in the second test. If England don't win at Edgbaston or don't have a very, very convincing draw, you kind of think the series is all over. So in terms of two teams are going to be really out there, and obviously at the same time Australia are going to be trying to nail home their advantage. So in terms of two people going out there with every interest in this match and specifically this match as the pivotal point in the series, I think, it's got all the ingredients, really.
There's been a lot of talk about momentum, and obviously, if we reversed Cardiff and Lords and England had got smashed at Cardiff and then gone and won at Lords convincingly, we'd all be bouncing with, great, great confidence into the Edgbaston Test. And there's been even some talk in the Australian press about moral leads, the fact that Australia now have a moral lead in the series. Jason Gillespie actually slammed that idea down, saying, look, it's 1-1, there's no sort of moral leads here. There is a parallel of sorts with 2005 in that England go into Edgbaston with they're seen as the underdogs. They've come off this big thrashing, and I think the other thing is we do have, much like 2005, we do still have this brave group of like young cricketers who I think still back themselves to beat Australia. There are players here, the Stokes, the Roots, or whatever, who I think are not sort of cowed. And that's very similar to that sort of 2005 feeling where you had a group of players who were no longer willing to accept this idea. And actually, going back to what we sort of spoke earlier, Vaughan was very clear on that. That was part of the success of 2005, that willingness to actually almost trick yourself into thinking we are competitive, we can beat this Australian team.
Well, look, I love that kind of, I think, slightly romanticized view that if you're young and unscarred, therefore, and possibly has some truth in it, young and unscarred, then you're going to go out and sort of not have the baggage of the past. I do just feel slightly worried about the fact that bounce back ability, as it
As
tends to
it's
be called, I think,
unfortunately known, yeah.
is not something that this English team has writ large over, in the sense that you don't have the kind of characters who have the ability to be humiliated, the kind of mavericks who are able to vacillate from one thing to the other. You've got Ian Bell, who hasn't scored, made a decent score in longer than we can think. Alastair Cook, who frankly isn't the most kind of, he's not the kind of inspirational captain who can turn a team around in the space of a week. You've got Johnny Bairstow coming in, who frankly, wonderful, ginger Yorkshire grit and everything, but he's no KP. And that's what kind of worries me about this game, that I'd like to think that England were going to sort of pull it out of the hat, as it were, but you do wonder their capacity to bounce back from such a humiliating defeat at Lord's.
I think what's really tricky is, and someone actually at work asked me this, someone who doesn't really follow cricket. They said, "How is it possible that England could win so well and then lose so badly?" They said, "Oh, this doesn't really happen in other sports, clearly." And I think it's really hard what conclusions you draw from that, because if we'd had two really competitive games, one of which England won narrowly, one of which Australia won narrowly, you'd say this is a really well-matched series. When it's 1-1 and you've had two teams inflict pretty convincing victories on each other, I mean, England's not quite as big as Cardiff, but still a very, very comfortable win at Cardiff, inside 4 days. What do you conclude?